Welcome back to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about, you guessed it, board games. Today, we're going to talk about the games we played last week. Then we are going to talk about some news and why it doesn't matter. And then on to our feature game, which is Leviathan. I'm here with my great friend, Mark. How are you this week, Mark?
It's Leviathan Wilds, Walker.
Leviathan Wilds. I'm here with my good friend, Mark. How are you this week, Mark?
I'm very good. I'm very pleased to be recording with a professional who certainly never gets the names of games wrong.
Ever.
Ever.
I missed a whole word.
Never happened.
You caught me again. What'd you play this week?
So, last week I got to play another session of Monikers. Monikers is the commercial version of the popular parlor game Celebrities. This was adapted by Alex Hagen, Justin Vickers at CMYK. I'm a big fan of CMYK and a lot of their designs. I even like some of their sillier stuff like Fuzzies, but they've also done Lacuna, and they've also done Spots. CMYK is a great publisher, and I like a lot of their output. I always am of two minds with respect to Monikers. One of the minds is, why don't you just play the open source version? The answer to that, to a certain extent, is the fact that Monikers adds a difficulty rating to different clues, and that means that the scoring is vastly more robust. And because when you play Celebrities with a cutthroat group, and you may say, Mark, it's absurd to play a party game like that with cutthroat people, but the number of people I've heard talk about how games work with their families, for example, it's like, whenever we gather together, we play X family game or Y party game or whatever, and then they start talking about the cousin or the uncle who regularly cheats, or the person who get really, really serious and don't talk to each other for a week after things that happened. Look, having a more structured, robust system doesn't necessarily mean that you're making it less fun or less of a party game. I talk about this all the time in the context of dexterity games. If you're going to have a fun toy with a solid rule set, that is better than having a fun toy without a solid rule set. I'll play both, but I prefer the former.
It's not a family party game unless it's covered with blood. That's how you know it's a good quality.
Yeah. And it is the case. I've heard people say this. When playing Celebrities, you have a perverse incentive to make all the clues as obscure as possible so that only you know who that person is and other people can't. And that leads to a painful session, right? So the fact that there's a scoring system built in, everyone's on the same page, there's an evaluation of what's less and more obscure. The problem is, and I encounter this all the time when playing Monikers, and this doesn't matter how many expansion packs you have, because there's a whole bunch of different expansion packs, themed expansion packs, promo expansion packs, you name it. There's invariably a bunch of weird niche internet cultural references from 8 to 9 years ago that have not aged well, because a lot of internet cultural references don't stick around. Is this going to be like What Does the Fox Say, which was stupid, but people kind of sort of know what it was? Or is it going to be like some stupid meme reference that people don't make anymore? It's hard to know. And I honestly find it a little unfortunate when you get some of those references like, I've never heard of that thing. Just, this is a very specific thing. I'm sure it was very funny for 6 months in 2014, but here we are. And I understand the pressure to make a cultural artifact is difficult, and it's hard to know what's going to age. That's precisely my point, but some of it has not aged well. So what I'm saying is that ideally what I would like to do, were I to get a copy of Monikers, is to very carefully curate the set.
Vet it up.
Yeah. Then, of course, the problem might be that what makes sense to me doesn't make sense to anybody else. So it's very, very personal. And to a certain extent, my intuition, my impulse, isn't to throw my hands up and say, well, then just play the open source one. If you're going to be left with some sort of morass of niche references anyway, might as well have the bespoke one where people have some degree of direct control over what enters the system. Anyway, all of that having been said, Monikers is great. It's very, very fun. For people not familiar, it's just a list of clues. First round, you can say whatever you want that is not the thing itself. Then, after all the cards have been scored, you then proceed to the second round, where all you're allowed to do is say a single word. And then the third round, only gestures. And consequently, it's a weird memory element. You might think, oh, how can you get it with a single word? It's like, well, you have to remember what was done in the first round when people could say as much as they like. It's a lot of fun. You can play with unequal teams. That's fine. People can come in and drop out. That's fine. People who are not good at improvising can still do a very good job in Monikers. And so it's a very, very flexible game. But again, it all lives and dies by the pool of clues. And sometimes I find it unsatisfying from that context. So that's Monikers. Very good adaptation, albeit sometimes a problematic one, of Celebrities. but it is guaranteed laughs. I've never had a session of monikers fall flat. Some party games have some possibility of falling flat. I've never had that problem with monikers. The worst that happens is there's a card, someone scowls, they do a word salad long enough for someone to finally get it, and everyone's like, what's that? I don't know. Move on.
Monikers. So you and I got to play a game. This is a game by designer Michael Kiesling and Wolfgang Kramer. They did a trio of games, which was Java, Tikal, and Mexica. I was lucky enough to play two of these games this week. Together we played Java. And Java and Tikal are very similar. In Java, it's all about sort of restrictive tile placement. And then you move some workers around that board, which is quite easy to move those workers around the board. Whereas Tikal is the opposite. The tile placement is just mandatory. You put it where somewhere on the board that's still open. And then the actual worker placement is very restrictive and important.
Well, you say worker placement, you mean here literally placing things that can be called workers. They're not actually worker placement games.
True.
This is just a
yes.
minor clarification.
This is true. They both look very identical because they both come with a player aid that tells yes. you how many action points you have and then lists all the actions and how many action points each of those actions take.
Well, originally they were the same publisher, same artist.
Yes.
There have been other editions of Tikal over the years. There was also another version of Mexica that was called something else.
I also found out there's a Tikal 2.
Yes.
That now I have to find and play.
It is not as well regarded.
And I've not played Mexica yet. And I looked everywhere to see if I could get it played online somehow so I could, say that I played all three, but...
Anyway. Yes, the so-called mask trilogy, because the covers of the original publications had indigenous masks on the front.
So, what do you think of Java, Mark?
Java is a very, very good implementation of a kind of mechanism and vibe that isn't really to my tastes, because crucially what's involved in Java is two portions. One of them is jockeying for control over these point-scoring cities. And ultimately, the way you do that, the sort of dovetailing in with that, the way you make cities, the way you score them, the way you jockey for control over the cities, is by a tile placement spatial puzzle kind of thing. And if you really know what you're doing, you start making these weird choke points so that people can't come in. You make it so that they can't generate higher elevations so you can't be bumped off your control of a city. And that part was very well implemented with a very, very simple and sparse rule set. And that dynamic I did not find intuitive or necessarily as satisfying as the jockeying part. So on the face of it, Tikal is much more to my taste because it's slightly more straightforward of an area majority game. Whereas in Java, it is very much about visualizing how you can place tiles so as to change the topography in such a way that you can then jump in and make an opening. And that spatial element I found very alien and very taxing. What I will say, though, in its favor, I enjoyed playing Java. It was extraordinarily well done, as I say. It reminded me a little bit of Calico, in that it is a very puzzly kind of tiling experience. But the difference is that whereas Calico was kind of sort of multiplayer solitaire, where I felt like I was satisfying scoring conditions that amounted to a spreadsheet, Java was much more interactive, much more dynamic in terms of how the map evolves, in terms of how the cities grow, and you're trying to horn in on other people's territories. And so I think that for people who like the vibe that Calico was putting down, they really ought to try Java. That's my impression.
Yeah, there's lots going on in Java. There's also like a sort of an end game thing that you're probably trying to play towards, because not only are you scoring or trying to score every time it's your turn, you're also trying to set yourself up for end game scoring, which is quite large as well. And then there's also this card system that's going along because you can, have
festivals.
And so then there's a, play until you can't play anymore type mechanic, which also was very interesting because you sort of have to decide how you're going to use your points. Are you going to draw cards? Are you going to move workers into positions that are going to help you now and or later? Are you going to try to block off parts of the map? I enjoyed everything about Java. It definitely felt like an older game for sure.
Yes. Not in the sense that it was kind of creaky, more in the sense that it was the vibe of this is what heavier games felt like 20 years ago,
to
a large extent. And indeed, Java is regarded as probably the heaviest, the most brain-burny of the three games of the Mask trilogy. I definitely feel that. I played Mexico once a long time ago, but I only have vague memories of it. The thing, though, that you reminded me, I really liked the festivals because the festival, setting yourself up for a festival, in many ways was some of the most strategic decision-making you find in Java. A lot of the play is very tactical. I've got these six action points. How much can I score for these six action points? Even the endgame scoring was often, look at the board, what city or cities can I steal in my final turn?
Also, and the little oases. Remember, we were like,
yes,
cornering them in at the last minute. I thought that was
absolutely
cool too.
And your turns are meaty enough so that, again, it feels very tactical. What can I do with my six action points? Which is good and bad. I mean, it's good in the sense that you feel like you're accomplishing something on your turn. It's bad that if you prefer more strategic horizons in terms of decision making, festivals are more or less it, because you need to put in the action points to get cards, and they may not pay off that turn, they may pay off later, but having that fistful of cards makes you in a very powerful position. You can then meander in workers, or even just leave workers lying around, knowing that whatever city gets founded there, you may not control it, you get to participate in the festival and use your big hand of cards. And that dynamic, actually, I really appreciated that overall dynamic. Now, that is possibly because I seemed to be the only person at the table spending action points to draw cards. But again, the spatial element of it was a little beyond my grasp. People were like, oh, I can horn in the city this way. And they placed a couple tiles like, I never would have seen that way in. But alas, as I say, if you enjoy the vibe of Calico, I would recommend Java. If you enjoy traditional Euro tile layers, I would also recommend Java. It's just this is the most spatially brain-burny of the sort of old-school Euro tile layers that I've played.
All right, now to get back to Cal, I played it on Board Game Arena. It is an alpha there. The developer is called Sir Euro. And what Cal is at the beginning of your turn, you're going to get a tile. And the board is this very large hexagon map that has a few temples near the base camp, say. And then when it's everyone's turn, at the beginning of their turn, they're going to play a tile. It's either going to be like an empty tile, or it's going to have some relics on it, or it's going to have a volcano. So you place that tile, and then you're given 10 action points to start populating the board with, let's call them explorers, so we don't get confused with workers. And so it costs, you know, 1 point to put them out, 1 point. And then to move them, there's these little stepping stones. So there's an interesting sort of way you can cut off parts of the map, because if there are no stones on that side of the hex, then you cannot go through there. But there could be stones on the other hex. So someone could, you know, somehow come in the back way to one of the hexes that you thought you had cut off. Anyway, each stone cost an action point to move through. And then so you're sort of setting your up. You can dig these temples higher. They're going to score points every time a volcano is drawn. And it's whoever has the most explorers in that hex is going to not going to score. When it's your turn, if you have the most explorers in the hex, you get to score that temple. So it's one of these games where the volcano will come up and then everyone gets an opportunity to have a scoring round. And so you're building up explorers, and then when it's the next player turns, they have to put even more explorers into that area if they want to try to score that temple, or they can just go off to other temples and dig them up quickly first. You can even cap off temples so they're yours for the whole turn. There's also this whole sort of relics you're collecting for sets going on as well. I've always enjoyed Tikal. I had it years and years ago, and it's a great game. Easy to teach, quick to play. Tikal.
Walker. I say Kiesling, you say Kramer. Kiesling. Played Wandering Towers by Michael Kiesling and Wolfgang Kramer. So this is one of their recent releases. It was published by Abacus Spiel in 2022. So they've been around for a long time, and they have a very, very fruitful and productive partnership. Now, Wandering Towers is a much lighter game than anything in the Mask Trilogy. And the Mask Trilogy wasn't particularly heavy. But this is a sort of one or two steps past family weight, I'd say. It's very much a lighter Euro. And it is almost exclusively tactical, in my experience. There are all these towers, and indeed, they're wandering around. And such that the geography is so radically different from one turn to the next, you might as well just put your hand away and wait for your turn before you figure out what's going on.
Is this the one I heard about where you, like, sort of put workers into the towers and you have to try to remember where they are and they move around the board? I so want to play this.
It's okay. There is a memory element. There are these towers that stack on top of each other. And if you move a tower on top of another tower, any workers or wizards that were on the previous tower, well, they're just covered up and you're not allowed to look. You have to remember where they are. I played a 6-player game, which was wild, utterly wild. And I only ever had 3 workers. Could I remember where these workers were? No. But then, as I say, Wandering Towers is so tactical that it's hard to really sit there and just pay attention to what everyone else is doing all the time, because it's not going to impact your move. So you sit there thinking, okay, I've got one on the second floor there. I've got one on the third floor there. Oh, wait, no, it's been swallowed. Now it's the fourth floor up. Ah! And then everything falls to pop. That part was fun. A certain degree of chaos, a little bit of humor and drama as you think, I think if I move this tower, oh no. I like that part. The problem is as follows. The goal of Wandering Towers is to get your wizards into a very specific tower. It's called, it's not called Ravenloft. It's called Raven's Keep. It was, but Ravenloft is, anybody who's ever played D&D will probably end up accidentally calling it Ravenloft once or twice. Raven's Keep is moving around. Your wizards are moving around. The people are all moving around. So far, so good. The problem is that everything is about exact movement. You play a card that moves your wizard 3, you move exactly 3. So if you move past Raven's Keep, well, that's not great. So don't do that.
Yeah, you can't move less.
You can't move less, and you can't move in a different direction.
Ah.
And consequently, anything that can give you flexibility is golden. And sure enough, there are these potions. First, you have to power them up by squashing other wizards. That part was fun. Then you could cash in these potions to trigger various special abilities, like move your wizard a single space, or move a tower back a couple spaces, or this, that, and the other. A certain degree of flexibility was absolutely necessary. I used my potions to get my first two wizards into Raven's Keep. And then you're in a position where you never get the potions back. So I don't necessarily feel like I made a mistake using those potions, but then I've got one wizard left. Doesn't matter whether you got one wizard left or a bunch of wizards left. You're then entirely at the mercy of whatever your cards tell you to do. You have a 3-card hand. You play 2 cards a turn. Near the end of the game, almost everyone was in the same situation. They didn't have any potions left, and they needed to wait until the board state conjoined miraculously with their hand such that they could get a wizard exactly in. So the end game dragged. I would be very much in favor of some sort of make it difficult, make it complicated, but some... well, not necessarily complicated. Some difficult way of getting your potions back so you could recharge them, get that flexibility back again.
Maybe the key is just to have your 3 sort of wizards close and then hopefully get them in without using up too many. I don't know.
Ideally, but then you're still in the same problem. And if they're close, then that's a high stakes gambit because if Raven's Keep then moves such that they're not close anymore, now they're all doomed. Ideally, what you want, I imagine, is to have them spaced out so you have maximum flexibility in terms of being able to get any of them into Raven's Keep at any given time. The problem is, eventually, you're going to be down to a single wizard. And ultimately, it just really highlights the extent to which all of this is being funneled through a very small card hand. Now, it's a relatively quick game with very few rules, and so the fact that it seems to be almost entirely dependent on luck of the draw near the end is not necessarily a fatal flaw. But I was unsatisfied with the end game. And I would have preferred some way
especially
to get some
six.
Flexibility.
Oof.
Well, it wasn't that long. The number of wizards you need to get home scales with the number of players.
I just mean, if everyone's struggling at the end, that means it's like, nope, can't do it,
yeah.
Can't do it. You're going around and around. And
yeah, pretty much.
That might feel
that
painful.
Is absolutely the vibe of the past few rounds.
Yeah.
That is true. So it was pleasant enough. I would probably prefer to play it with 3 or 4. That seems to be a better number. But that might just lead to a more protracted endgame. I don't know. As it was, it didn't overstay its welcome too long. It's just the last few turns were unsatisfying. So it was more about the experience than the duration necessarily. That's Wandering Towers by Michael Kiesling and Wolfgang Kramer.
We streamed a few games this week. The main Saturday stream was Morgan's Magic Map and Tiny Towns. So Morgan's Magic Map was designed by Gian Andrea Cabzuno and published by Rio Grande Games. So they have 15 tiles that form a square at the beginning, in whatever order you want. And then you start getting these hands of cards, and you have an explorer out on the map. And your hand of cards will say something like, this particular tile has to be 3 away, this tile has to be 2 away, and this one you have to be on.
Oh, no.
Right? And you don't have to have all of these things come true. You're allowed
okay.
to score as many as you want, but ideally, you want to have all of them score.
Oh, I see.
So the first thing you get to do is move one of the tiles somewhere else.
Oh my goodness.
So you're moving the tile around and then you get to move your adventurer.
I'm not saying it's because the game sounds bad. The
yeah.
game sounds like my nightmare.
It does. It really does. So and then you
why
get to
does
move...
Morgan want me to suffer? Why has Morgan invented this magical map as a means of torturing me?
He hates you for some reason.
Wow, I'm
why.
So glad I wasn't there. Oh my goodness.
So then you move your pirate 2 spaces. And then, yeah, and then you show your cards. Yeah, I moved to that. This is 1. This is the space I'm on at 0. This tile's 2 away, and this tile's 3 away. And then there's the scale of treasure. And then so you collect the treasure. So I found it very interesting. There's like a few water features on the tiles that will sort of limit where they can go. But you are allowed to turn them however you want. So sometimes it doesn't matter, but sometimes it does. And sometimes you get a whole hand of 0 cards.
Yeah.
And you can't be on all those tiles.
Of course.
Sometimes you'll get multiples of the same tile at, 0, 2, and 3. And that won't work either.
Sure.
But Other than that, I found it very interesting, played very quickly, and would be happy to play it again. That's Morgan's Magic Map. And Tiny Towns was a game I've been waiting to play. This is designed by Peter McPherson and put out by AEG Games. It got a little bit of buzz, so I wanted to give it a try. It's very much like sort of a Cascadia other type of game. You have a grid, and there's a set of cards that represent buildings. And then people start picking colors of cubes, and you're putting on this your grid map. And when you have the right combination of colored cubes on the grid in the right formation, you've built the building that you want. You remove those cubes, and you place the building in one of the squares that the cube one of the cubes was on. And all of the buildings have different scoring options, depending on what buildings you decide to pick. Because there's a giant, you know, deck of different, you know, colored buildings and different scoring chances. And it was all right. It's one of these games, I don't know if you ever played the app, where you're combining things together.
Yes.
And it starts blocking up your map.
Yep.
So you have to sort of perfectly make these Tetris shapes of the cubes and then sort of, you know, bring them up into the corner so they're not blocking big chunks of your map where you want to place other buildings. So that being said, somewhat solitaire. You can sort of, when you don't really care what color that you want at the particular moment, because, you know, some of the buildings require wild and this is your last cube, you can sort of take a quick look around and say, well, brown would be bad for everyone, so I choose brown. And you have to take the color. That's the other key part of this game, is that someone says brown, everyone has to take a brown cube and put it somewhere on their map. So it could be very bad, which usually was. Tiny Towns is definitely worth a play to see it if it is your jam, because if it is, I'm sure you'll have lots of fun. Tiny Towns.
Life is too short to spend too long without playing a game by David Thompson. And so we played Sniper Elite the Board Game again by Roger Tankersley and the aforementioned David Thompson. This is a review copy we got from the publisher. Still my favorite hidden movement game. And let me tell you what Huey did. This was an evocation, I think, of some of the drama and surprise and interesting cat-and-mouse dynamics that you can get in Sniper Elite, because the sniper, who's the hidden movement player, has to go and sabotage a couple of objectives. And in this particular case, Huey had, as the sniper, a couple of objectives near the north of the map. One was in the northeast, one was in the northwest. We had him kind of bottled in the northeast, around objective two. But then he left. Left that area of the map. We were very clear that we were very certain that he was gone. We didn't know exactly where he was. And so we reached the conclusion, given that he had not sabotaged Area 2, that he didn't have Area 2 as an objective. And he spent a long time, a long portion of the game in that area of the map. So he leaves. He barely in time goes and sabotages the area in the northwest. We had him kind of cornered a couple times, but he managed to slip out of our grasp through clever use of equipment cards. And then we started thinking about where he was headed next. And we started looking at the board and we figured, well, it can't be this because you can't have two objectives in the same sector. He could be headed that way. So, Louis, why don't you go and protect that area of the map? And it could be this area. So I'm going to move some of my guards. No, it was objective two. He was hanging around there and then he just left. It was an act of such courage. I mean that sincerely. It was very gutsy move. He's like, no, I'm going to cut my losses. I'm going to come back and take care of this later. And in so doing, he completely threw us for a loop because I in particular was so certain that if that had been one of his objectives, he would have just done it and accepted the fact that he would have been at a little bit of risk at the time.
Yeah, because you are under a time constraint. So it's not as though you can just, you know, do whatever. You are under a little bit of pressure
right.
as the sniper. Yeah.
And it was because of that time constraint that I assumed that the delay he experienced in that corner was just so as to be safe, not because he was trying to find a way to sabotage that objective. But no, it was amazing. And then after the game, Huey walked us through where he went each turn and the steps he had to take to avoid this, that, and the other. It was great. It was a wonderful session. And there were no mistakes, no confusion. One of the big problems with hidden movement games of this ilk is if the hidden mover makes a single mistake, sometimes the game can completely fall apart. And I have to say, it's not that we've never had mistakes in Sniper Elite, but it is a simpler and more streamlined and transparent system with very, very clearly interesting maps when compared to a lot of other hidden movement opportunities. And so the mistakes have been vastly fewer and vastly more toxic to the overall game state than in others. And I thoroughly enjoy Sniper Elite. None of us like the video game upon which it's based. Louis is like, yeah, I tried it. I really didn't like the violence. And these are people that already play violent video games. And my objection, just once again, was there this strangely morbid system whereby you get personal little factoids about the person you're about to dome. It was so strange. Anyway, so I was leery because it's a genre that I don't tend to enjoy and tends to be error prone. And it's a video game franchise that does nothing for me. But Sniper Elite, the board game, is truly engaging and wonderful and simple and approachable and tense and satisfying. And so I highly, highly, highly recommend Sniper Elite, the board game by Roger Tankersley and David Thompson, published by Rebellion Unplugged.
A game called Earthborn Rangers, Mark, had got a lot of buzz. And so we wanted to get a copy. I wanted to get a copy.
We are slaves to the buzz, Walker.
We are slaves to the buzz. It's just so. And we've had a lot of bad experiences with games like this, like games like Splendid Vale, games like Seventh Continent, games where you're looking up numbers of
Sleeping Gods.
Sleeping Gods. It says, turn to this page, get this card out. Paragraph-driven
story narrative games, yes.
Do stuff. So we did not have high hopes.
Nope.
But Adam Sandler, Bradley Sandler, is in the group of many designers with Andrew Fisher and Brooks Fugger-Levitt and Andrew Navarro. So lots of designers in this Earthborn Rangers. It is very much a card-driven system with little book lookups, not as many as these other games. And so you're picking, you're choosing classes, and within those classes, there are groups of cards that you can take for your deck. And then you're just passing checks. One of these systems where it's like you need a level 2 check. And so you're, you know, playing cards or spending this energy because you pick your sort of 4 stats that you're going to have at the beginning. You're spending things off of that.
And that honestly was one of the reasons why I was so leery about Earthborn Rangers, because there have been so many story-based, check-driven games. Pass this check to put so many successes on this thing. Advance to the next chapter when you've got X successes on the thing. And that's what I didn't like about the Arkham Horror, the card game. It was just, I felt tedious, and you were just bashing your head against the wall, and sometimes you can't do the checks. Sometimes there are attributes that none of your characters are good at. You got the cards you have or you don't, and on top of that, the overall chapter structure is very, very rigid. And that all of this was contributing to my general sense of disinterest when approaching Earthborn Rangers.
And I think we're both pleasantly surprised. I enjoyed our session. And it's one of these games where you can sort of, like another game I'm going to talk about next, where you just sort of play until you want to stop. There are some sort of pivotal points where it says it's best to stop. But as you go, and I liked it because it wasn't this one of this, you know, you are the main god, and you're going to go slay the other gods.
No, definitely not a power fantasy.
And
no.
it's much lighter. It's like, hey, you're the new sort of ranger guy. Here are some biscuits. Go introduce yourself to the locals. And I love that. Something a little bit different than the usual fare that we've been having recently. I love the combinations that you can get in your deck where you're, you know, this animal will help you do this, and then you play this other card that will untap your animal, and then you get to do that again. There's also sort of levels of locations. There's cards in front of you, and then there's the middle, and then there's the thing that's far away, and then you sort of get exhausted if you're trying to do things that are further away and there are cards in the way. I like that system as well.
So it gets a lot right. Earthborn Rangers was clever in that, for one thing, there are generic tests that you can always do. And so you're not entirely at the mercy of whatever cards you happen to have. And so there are fundamental actions you can always perform. And you have this energy that refreshes every turn. And so you do feel like every turn there is stuff for you to do. And in a number of narrative games like this, as I said, there's the one thing you're trying to do and everything else feels like a bit of a waste of time. Hopeless checks seems to be built into a lot of these narrative type games. You're just desperately trying to find the right combination of things or hoping for a really fluky random modifier. Earthborn Rangers really flattens that out and makes you feel like there's a lot more control and a lot less flukiness. You're able to scout a lot of decks. Like, for example, my character was able every turn to look at the top card of the challenge deck, which is the random modifiers that can apply.
Yeah, that was the one deck I was most worried about.
Right.
It's like every time you do a check, you have to flip over one of these cards and you're going to get a plus or a minus. And it's like, okay, you're going to go through all this trouble of spending this vital energy and this one card that you happen to have. And then randomly you're going to fail because of a weird
card. Because that's how all the other games like this work.
Yes.
And it's frustrating and tedious. And Earthborn Rangers, first of all, the modifiers are gentle. And secondly, you can exercise a fair bit of control over a number of the levers. Even if your character doesn't have the ability to control what the challenge deck looks like, they might have the ability to control what another deck looks like, or better ability to get cards in their hand, or what have you. So that part I very much appreciated. Mechanically, in that sense, I felt that it was vastly more solid, vastly more focused, vastly more grounded than a lot of these other narrative check-driven games. The part where it started to fall apart under its own weight was the overall structure, because very much like how a hidden movement game can lead to a fail state if somebody makes a mistake and they're not where they're supposed to be, or they didn't give you the bit of information they were supposed to give you, if you manage to get out of the carefully curated environment of paragraph A leads to paragraph J leads to paragraph K leads to paragraph B, then the game can break and you don't know what's going on. You have to reconstruct things. I don't think we did that in our session of Earthborn Rangers, but there were several instances where we weren't sure.
Yes.
It wants to offer you a very loose structure in which you have maximum ability to explore the world. I wasn't particularly interested in exploring the world. I'm very prosaic and straightforward, so to a certain extent, my perspective doesn't gel with this, but it's like, I'm a satisfy these missions. And then this mission was like, well, in order to do this mission, you have to go and do this other thing. It's like, okay, fine. And then I wasn't sure that the two missions were still working. They did, mostly.
I think we got to the final point where we're supposed to be okay, but how we got there,
yeah.
I don't think was within the limits of, I think we were supposed to pass out the biscuits.
Uh-huh.
Around the tree. Nowhere did it say we couldn't leave the tree.
Yeah.
And we, of course, said, so long, tree.
So long, tree.
And we went out and gave biscuits to other people.
Yes. I think it's part of the freeform intention of the structure of Earthborn Rangers. The thing is that there are lots of really good elements, but it starts to creak under its own weight. The way everything hangs together is nebulous in my mind. Part of that is a rules problem. Part of that is a structure problem. Part of that is a writing problem. Part of that is a paragraph pathing problem. It all comes together. It needed a few more passes with the editing. Now, to be fair, typically how you get to a much more solid, less creaky feeling narrative experience is you either make it very rigidly chapter driven, like Arkham Horror, the LCG, open this door in this weird nightmarish hellscape with this test. Oh, I'm not good at that test. Like, well, good luck, buddy. See you on the other side. And then you get to the next chapter and it's all very, very clearly delineated. Or you make the game systems a lot less complicated. That's how Legacy of Dragonhold did it. Legacy of Dragonhold, to me, is still the gold standard of these narrative games. In terms of writing, in terms of personality, in terms of the right level of gamification, in terms of the correct degree of liberty. Earthborn Rangers, I think, wants things to be more free-flowing than they are, and so therefore the rules checks get more burdensome as a consequence. So it doesn't hang together nearly as well as I would have liked. I like how tests work. I like how all the mechanisms work with one glaring exception that I'll get to in a second. I just feel like the overall structure creaked under its own weight and made the rules more confusing than they needed to be. The one part of the game of Earthborn Rangers that I very much don't like is the level of deck customization is really non-existent. You build your deck at the start with a whole bunch of choices that you don't understand the consequences of. It's like, hey, have four classes. How do these classes work? Well, here's the two-line summary. Choose four backgrounds. What are these backgrounds? I don't know. Choose some personality types. Like, okay. And you get this grab bag of stuff. And congratulations. That's your deck forever. It's very strange.
Yeah, they say after like the huge plot points, I think there's sort of like a little exchange that you're allowed to do, but it's very minor.
Well, it's a function of what rewards you've earned.
Yes.
So far in our session, we've earned a reward, so one of us will be able to swap out two of the cards of our 30-card deck, and there you go. Now, all of this, just to be very clear, to circle back, this was our first session, and the intro set, like basically the first mission and a couple of side missions that we did for kicks. I don't know where the narrative is going, tonally or plot-wise. Am I curious to find out? Not especially, because the quality of the writing, the quality of the world-building didn't really impress me all that much. It wasn't obnoxious, and mechanically, just, you know, again, going through the tests, managing your energy for the turn, managing your hand, all that stuff was good. Am I willing to play again? Yeah. I look, if someone wants to play it again, I'm even vaguely curious. I might even suggest it. That is vastly better than I felt about any other narrative game since I played Legacy of Dragonlord, because all the other ones that we played have been like, this is tiresome and tedious, and you are just introducing boring game mechanisms to waste my time before I read the next mediocre paragraph of writing. So not very good experiences. Earthborn Rangers is vastly better than all of those. And it completely blew my expectations away, but they started out in the basement. So,
just so. You pretty well summed up what I was going to say. I have a feeling that we are going to go back to it at least once more. And so, look forward to that.
Okay. Earthborn Rangers. And, of course, it is worth emphasizing that the overall attitude of the publisher with respect to conservation, both in terms of the way they publish and manufacture games and in the overall setting, is to be commended. We've talked before that we are somewhat late in this hobby to coming around to seriously grappling with the environmental impacts of a lot of our actions. And so it's good that more and more people are taking this perspective. And Earthborn Games, the publishers of Earthborn Rangers, are very, very, very forward and clear and explicit with those intentions. And I applaud that. So it's worth emphasizing. Played another game of Through the Desert. This is the new all-play edition. I am perfectly happy with the new edition of Through the Desert. Part of me misses the slightly chunkier pastel camels. We did, however, come with a finalized set of colors, because originally you had a variety of sweet tart flavors to indicate the color of camels, plus detergent. That's at least what we do in our household. And Walker has now successfully identified the different flavor colors. The new, slightly different shade of green, but not quite green, is apple. So now we have apple and detergent. So that was very clarifying. We've got lemon, cherry, apple, detergent, and grape.
Just so.
Sincerely, that makes me feel a lot more comfortable with the new edition. Not necessarily in terms of its quality, but in terms of just how to address things. And we didn't try any of the new modules this time because we were playing with a new player. Dr. Stallone had not yet played Through the Desert, which led to shocks of indignation, rightfully so. Every time, when he first said it to me, I'm like, and then when I told everyone else, everyone was shocked. The only person who wasn't shocked was Chip the Third, but he's pretty unflappable. Chip
it's
the
true.
Third is. So I had a great opportunity to introduce Through the Desert. I've been thinking about things, and I sincerely think that Through the Desert belongs in my top 20 games. It's just so clean and so excellent, and the ratio of rules grit to quality decision-making in player interactivity is so amazing. I think in that particular sense, in terms of the efficiency of rules, it may be the best hobbyist game ever published, frankly. And I've never had a bad time playing Through the Desert, and people can take to it very, very quickly. And it's just so dynamic, and you never know where it's going to go. It has identifiable early, mid, and late games. And if you really want to excel, you have to be able to plan for each of those stages. But at the same time, you never feel like you're going to get locked out. It's such a brilliant achievement in terms of game design. And I enjoy it thoroughly every time I play it.
And it has that very thorough, old-school Euro conflict feeling. It's very player interactive, tons of blocking, even sort of blocking for the sake of blocking.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
But of course, it's a trade-off. It's a game of constant tense trade-offs. Sometimes you have to think about whether it's worth it to get the one point off of the corner of the map. But then you might think, well, no one is going to threaten me for that, so I can afford this turn to give up the tempo just to horn in on someone else's territory. Yeah, brilliant. Through the Desert, the new edition, was published by Allplay, formerly BoardGameTables.com. But seriously, any edition is marvelous. Any Through the Desert is good to have.
Got to play Mythwind. This is a game that came out that people were talking about. This is published by Open Owl Studios, designed by Walker.
I think we should have an intervention. This is a mini intervention, just me.
I didn't say buzz. I said people were talking about. I didn't say it got buzzed.
I think you can give yourself permission to not play something,
gotcha,
even if other people are talking about it.
All right.
Okay. I'm very sorry to interrupt. Please continue. Tell me about Mythwind.
So I got to play Mythwind, a game that I wanted to try.
Because you're a grown-up big boy and you do whatever you want?
I wear big boy pants.
And no one tells you what to do.
That's right. This is designed by Nathan Liege, Brendan McCaskill, put out by Open Owl Studios. It's a game you can't win, it's a game you can't lose, and it's a game that never ends. Now, I'm going to compare it to phone apps. A lot of them have names that are idle, like idle Roller Coaster Tycoon, Idle Pizza something, Idle. And it's just that you move someone around and you do stuff. And there's same sort of thing. There's no sort of win condition. You just keep doing things. And this is what you do in Mythwind. And it's very Merchant Cove-like, where there is a base set of rules. And then there are all the different occupations that everyone gets their own mini game, and they're all very different. So I tried it with the farmer. They have all these polyomino shapes, a bunch of wilderness that starts on your board. So you have to place them just right so they're not touching, but leave you enough room to start planting crops. And you have crops and you have cattle, and you're doing this sort of growing and watering and selling. And then it's another turn and you grow some more.
Okay.
And then you water some more.
Uh-huh.
And then you sell them.
I think I'm getting a vibe.
There is a building. There's a building element where you start building elements. So what you're doing is you have your this big chonkers pawn. Wait till you see these pawns. Not that you'll ever play this game. But you have these giant pawns. And so you take a town action, which is going to do a bunch of different things, like get you workers or let you start building buildings or upgrade things, because you have this main set of sort of stats on the side, sort of normal civ type stats like culture and money and food for the town. And you have to keep those up to certain levels.
Or nothing.
Don't worry about it. That's what I mean. Because there's also a goal, right? It's like by the end of a season, there are 9 weather cards. So there is sort of like an end to a season where it says you can stop there. You know, you can play a different character and continue on. And so there's a goal card that you have to get to certain things. Do you know what happens if you don't? Nothing. Don't worry about it. But I can see the relevance. They say it's a cozy game. It's this new sort of
genre. Yeah, we talked about it on Pledge of Indifference, and cozy came cozy up all game. The time. Yeah,
And it was all right. I just feel as though the iconography needed to be not only bigger on the cards, but also needed to be more clear. Because they do have this whole work mechanic. There are the humans that will come to work for you and fairies that will also come work for you. And they are represented by dice. Now, you hire them from the tower and they come over to your board. And then you start placing them in the different actions that you can take on your board. Because like I said, you take your pawn, you do a town action, and then you have your own actions that you can do on your board. And then all your workers can do actions. Then there's the iconography for the workers. Now, workers can get populated back to the tower. Workers can get turned to different pips on them. Workers can do all these different things, but the iconography is so small and it's not clear when they come back to the tower or how you're going to get to hire more, because only 2 start there and there's no actions that will get more workers there. So I think it would be problematic with many players, because since there's only 2, I hired them both in the first turn. Nobody else would get any dice.
It doesn't
workers.
Scale with number of players?
It does not.
Wild.
Well, it's supposed to be cooperative, right? So
it's supposed to be cozy walker.
You'd probably only hire 1, let someone else hire 1. Every time you use them, they dial down. And when they get to 0, they're going to go back to the tower. There are ways that more workers will come to the tower, but it's not intuitive.
I see.
You go on adventures maybe, or you know, you do the events and more workers will come, but the icons that say they come to the tower, it's so unclear. It's like, does this mean they come here or do they go there? Or anyway, it was a little frustrating. Gonna play it some more. This is only after 1 play. We'll give it a go. I'm gonna see if Huey, I think it might be his type of game. We'll give it a roll with Huey and see if he likes it. I did enjoy it. There's no, don't say that. Like I enjoyed this type of thing. I enjoy going through the steps. And like I said, it's much like the apps. You know, you sit and you puzzle out how the dominoes are going to go and how you're going to, even though there's no downfall to it, it's still kind of fun to work the levers.
Sure. And it's not that a game has to have rigid win or loss conditions. It's just there's a reason why that structure tends to be so pervasive. It's helpful in terms of delineating a session. It's helpful in terms of giving you tangible things to work towards rather than just, you know, fiddling around with the levers just for the levers' sake. And both Earthborn Rangers and Mythwind, it would appear, in varying ways, are trying to recontextualize what pulling those levers means. And I'm open to the prospect. It's just often it's difficult to control the pacing and the overall engagement in those contexts. So I'm skeptical.
And there is a very light storyline going on in the background, too. There's these event cards that will come up based on what weather cards come up. And so there's these sprites out in the wilderness, and eventually I feel as though they might come and help you out, do some other actions. So maybe it'll be interesting. We'll see.
Played more Tapple.
Tapple.
Tapple's great. Tapple is the timed word game where you go through a category and you have to think of a new instance of that category using a initial word, that a letter, rather, that has not yet been used. I am increasingly of the opinion, though, that more clarity needs to exist with respect to proper names. I'm not saying this with respect to the travesty that you engaged. No, I mean this. So, like, if the category is historical figures, right, are we talking first names, last names, middle names, what? We play fast and loose. We tend to do it both. But as a consequence, anything involving proper names just ends up being about twice as easy as any other category because we've allowed both. In a perfect world, I think there should be more clarification, more rigor. But I realize that the more you do that, the more complicated things get, the more difficult it gets to teach, and the more difficult it is to remember how the appropriate house policies work. So I'm of two minds with respect to that. It's just some of the categories strike me as less rigorous or obvious than others. And it's a little awkward when someone gives a guess and a couple people at the table are like, really? It's not the best feeling. So, but Tapple remains amazing. I appear, though, to have tappled your Tapple Walker sufficiently hard that sometimes when you try to tapple the Tapple, it doesn't tapple properly. I think this is because of my past abuse of Tapples.
You toppled it. Lastly for me.
It's topical. Yeah.
I played a fantastic game. This is sort of to top off our G.I. Joe themed. We played the deck building game. We finished the whole campaign. And to top it off, we played G.I. Joe Battle for the Arctic Circle, which was a review copy from Renegade Game Solutions. And it is using the Axis and Allies system to play G.I. Joe versus Cobra. And it had all the member berries. Every single member berry in that box.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Well, you have the G.I. Joe and you have Axis and Allies.
Sure.
So it had all the feels. There are three scenarios in the rule book, but there is a whole community of Axis and Allies people that I'm sure will come up with a million more scenarios for the G.I. Joe Axis and Allies game. So we played the first one. It sort of populates the board out, and I don't want to say they fixed Axis and Allies. Because for some people, this is not a fix. But for mild gamers, you know, like that play some different games and don't play the same game multiple times,
right,
like they did with Risk, they put a turn limit on it and they put in objectives. Mm. So there's victory points on the board that you're fighting for. They have very interesting G.I. Joe powers for a lot of the different units. Overall, I think almost everyone had a great time, especially Louis and I, because we are of the old school. And so G.I. Joe Axis and Allies had everything I wanted it to have and more.
I'm very happy for you, Walker. Compared to other hobbyist troops on a map games, do you think it holds up?
I think so, 100%.
Good.
I think it brings, like I said, it cuts that very fine line. Like, they've reduced all of the rules,
right,
to make it more streamlined. All of the units fight all the time. It's not like the first strike for this unit, and because it's the seventh turn, Russia now gets this. You know, it's none of that stuff. It's
right.
Everyone fights when they need to. There's a few light rules in there. The leaders have special abilities, but I think it just cuts that very fine line between, you know, overly, like, here is a troops on the map game that is accessible to many more people.
And it's team-based, right?
It is.
Yeah, so you don't have to worry about all the multiplayer conflict problems, but then again, the player count gets a little fragile.
True. True. You could play it with less, but then they're just using more. And the one thing that this does that Axis and Allies does not do, if you don't use all your build points, they have a little bank on the side.
Okay.
So you can, you know, put up the bank. And when it's your teammates' turn, they could use that bank if they want. Or you could wait and use them. Yeah, I thought that was neat. G.I. Joe, Battle for the Arctic Circle.
Those are the games we played last week. Now a brief break to pay some bills. It's all too easy to spend over $100 a month on streaming services. Netflix, Disney+, Prime, you name it. But if you use ExpressVPN, you can cut back to just Netflix and save a bundle every month. You can use ExpressVPN to change your online location to over 100 different countries and access the unique media libraries available in those regions. No more having content hidden from you. ExpressVPN is unobtrusive, fast, works on almost any kind of device, all while protecting your privacy online. I've been hearing rave reviews about Scavenger's Reign, and thanks to ExpressVPN, I've been watching it on American Netflix. Like anime? Well, pretend to be in the UK, and you can watch the original Cowboy Bebop, not that other version. It's so simple. You just open the app, select a country, and refresh your browser to be wherever you want and watch what people in your country normally can't. So go for it. Get access to more and pay less. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/sowronggames. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/sowronggames to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. This week's episode is sponsored by Incogni. Every time I've been to a bank in the past year, I've overheard someone ask if a recent phishing email or text or other message they've received was actually been from their bank. I get it. These scammers have powerful tools at their disposal, thanks to data brokers that traffic in your private information without your knowledge. The good news is that you have access to tools, too. Incogni is a service that automatically removes your private data from the brokers that are all too happy to sell your privacy away as though you were the product. And since these data brokers can scrape your data again without your permission, Incogni will keep getting that data removed as many times as it takes while you have a subscription. Ever since I signed up with Incogni, I've had a drastic decrease in the number of robocalls, spam emails, and other scams from people trying to spoof email addresses of my friends and family. So try Incogni now. Use code ABOUTGAMES at incogni.com/aboutgames to get an exclusive 60% off an annual Incogni plan. That's code ABOUTGAMES at incogni.com/aboutgames.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we're back. On to the news and why it doesn't matter. So Seismic is back on crowdfunding, and we've talked a lot about Seismic on the show, but I just wanted to give one more shout out to the designer, Jason Blake, because he recently posted an update on the campaign page that offers the kind of transparency and detail that you don't often find, because the economics of the board game market, more and more people are being transparent and straightforward. Like, for example, some designers, Bruno Faiduti, most recently among them, has been talking about, here's the amount of royalties I get, here's where they come from. And a number of people have been complaining, or at least requesting, different kinds of pledge tiers for Seismic. They're like, well, I want this pack, but not the other pack. Could I buy them separately? And very frequently, what they think they're doing is they want to save $10 by stripping out the content they don't want. And one of the things that is very often difficult to understand is, no, the moment you start making a universe of more and more SKUs, you lose a lot of those cost savings, and the bundle that you're talking about wouldn't be cheaper than the bundle you're passing on. It would be more expensive than the bundle you're passing on if we were to package everything separately and package it in the way that you think you want. So you're not actually paying for content you don't want. You're actually saving overall and getting the extra content on top of it. And so going through in detail and talking about this and manufacturing costs is very illuminating for me, from someone who doesn't have a background in business, doesn't have a background in retail or packaging or manufacturing, all those things. And I applaud the fact that more and more designers, like in the case of Seismic, like in the case of Bruno Faiduti, are being more transparent about this business arm. Because for a long time, you know, we just don't talk about these numbers as a broad rule. I don't think there's some sort of shroud of secrecy. It just hasn't been the practice. And so moving away from that standard, I think, is great. So just check out the latest update to Seismic on GameFound if you're at all curious about the way it works in that project. Again, I applaud the transparency. Seismic on GameFound. Also, I really hope the game gets funded, because I really want to play Seismic.
It's true. As do I. It's a great Troops on the Map game that adds so much more.
So much spectacle. It's a game of spectacle.
It is.
And so,
news for me. It's Ada's Dream. This is the new game that's been announced by Alicat Games. Once again, it'll go on to crowdfunding. This time, the designer is going to be Tony Lopez. So, not the normal team for Alicat's annual game. Still looking forward to it. It looks great. The next piece of news is, if you enjoy board game drama, boy, is this some drama. I'm not going to give you all of the stuff, Mark, because this is long. And so I'll give you the highlights. And if this stuff kind of interests you, there are many, many creators that have done full in-depth stuff. I got my information from Board Game Co. He also did a light over. I'm going to do even lighter than he did, but other content creators have gone more into it. So this is a game called Wonders of the First CCG. So first of all, they said, we are going to have AI art. We don't care. We love AI art. All AI art all the time. And we're going to have NFTs as well. Why not? NFTs too. Unfortunately, NFTs went against Kickstarter's policy. So, bop. Off of Kickstarter it goes. We're back. No NFTs this time. So they didn't get as much money, but that's okay. Everyone's going to review bomb it on BGG. We don't like it because it has AI art. So they announce on the crowdfunding, hey, go to BGG and give us a positive review to, you know, offset these negative reviews. Strictly against BGG's policy. As the producer and or designer of a game, you cannot suggest such things. All of those reviews deleted. The designers didn't like that. So they somehow found the phone number of the owner of Board Game Geek and called him personally to complain about this.
Oh my goodness.
All of this drama and more for Wonders of the First CCG. Wow.
That's a lot.
And that's the end of the news for this week. And why it doesn't matter. On to our feature game, which is Leviathan Wilds.
Leviathan Wilds is the initial offering from Mood Crab Games. It was designed by Justin Kampanen. Justin Kampanen was a staff worker for FFG and for Z-Man Games for a number of years. And he has design credits on a bunch of games, although it's not really clear that he was the lead designer on any of them. And in point of fact, in the past, we incorrectly inferred that he did some initial design work on Condottieri. He did not. He worked on the redesign of Condottieri, such is the way of things. In point of fact, the original design was exclusively by Dominic Erhard, which, strangely enough, is the artist for my edition of Medici. So there you go. It all comes full circle. Not involving Leviathan Wilds. But anyway, Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Leviathan Wilds?
Leviathan Wilds delivers on everything that it promises. It's Attack on Titan. You and your friends jump on these giant monstrosities. You're helping each other out. You're flying around. You're crushing these chaotic crystals that are driving this creature insane or mad or evil. You are using special abilities. You are using how your particular occupation works versus how your character works, and they're mixed together. And then it's over. It is compact. It flows perfectly. It is everything that it promises. Leviathan Wilds.
I would say it's more of a Shadow of the Colossus vibe because I do not recall, granted I haven't played every single scenario multiple times over in Leviathan Wilds, but so far it has not endorsed fascism, and therefore I would say it is very different from Attack on Titan.
I suppose.
But at any rate, moving on, I take your point. It is a pure co-op where the board is going to be different for every scenario, and the board consists of a Leviathan. Very consonant art styles, but very different design philosophies for a lot of them. Might be giant rock snake, might be giant rock dude, might be weird spider monster thing.
Giant beholder eyeball monster.
Giant beholder eyeball monster. Don't want to get into too much detail because that might constitute spoilers. And there's the very thinnest veneer of narrative tying it together. The very thinnest. We're talking about like a paragraph on a card for each Leviathan. So it's not really a big deal. But it does serve to inject a certain degree of personality because every climber has a little background, a little tongue-in-cheek sort of notion. It's all the tone is very adventurous. It's not very heavy, even though these giant creatures are being corrupted by some sort of crystalline infestation. And I just want to stress right away one of the things that I love the most about Leviathan Wilds, and that is that the map is thematic and mechanically satisfying. Because you are free climbers, you're climbing all over these things. And there's a very serious sense that going up is more difficult than going down. And a number of game mechanisms interact with that. You know, you can glide down, you can fall down. Sometimes you fall deliberately, sometimes you fall by accident. And all of this matters. And so the topography is, I'm going to compare this a lot to Pandemic. I love Pandemic. I probably, of our core group, other than Dewey, like Pandemic more than anybody else. You don't dislike it, but you're not as jazzed on it as I am. I think Pandemic has remained a perennial classic of the co-op genre for a reason. I don't think it just invented the modern standards. I think it, in very many ways, almost perfected the modern standards. But one area in which the geography of Leviathan Wilds is more thematically engaging than the geography of Pandemic is, it's not just a question about whether or not there's a line between Toronto and Chicago that matters in the context of going somewhere. It matters what direction that's in terms of being able to clamber all over these giant monstrosities. And that just makes me feel like so much of the game hangs together in a really satisfying way.
True. And not only is there this very light narrative in the background, like you said, each Leviathan comes with its own deck of cards. And within that deck, there could be just little mechanisms that makes that Leviathan so much different than the other ones. And then on top of that, they all have 6 to 7 cards that you're going to cycle through that give them their abilities. And they're all different, not hugely different. Don't get, you know, out of control. Like, they're going to be this weird thing. It's all like sort of different templates or different ways they attack or different. They focus more on the corruption or focus more on damage, all different ways that the Leviathan will act. And so they're changed every turn. Not only that, they're different for every Leviathan.
I do, however, find that the ways in which the Leviathans differ are mechanically trivial and very satisfying over the course of the gameplay. So often we play these board games where, like, there's 20 different scenarios, and it's like, yeah, whatever. I mean, it doesn't really feel any different at all. But resolving the different Leviathan effects is so easy. You don't have to learn new rule systems, but you do start to learn their attack patterns because there are only 6 or 7 cards and they do cycle through. One in particular, which was the most satisfying, the map was divided up into columns, and we would know, okay, this column has already triggered this go around. That means that I can end in these other spaces, but it's more dangerous. And again, that interacts with the geography of the Titan in particular that you're clambering, of the Leviathan that you're clambering all over. So you've got, now you got Attack on Titan in the brain. I hate thinking about Attack on Titan.
Sorry.
For one thing, they are clothed, or at least not obviously nude. I'm prudish. That's not even the top 10 of my problems Attack on Titan. Please send all your complaints to support@aircanada.ca. But yeah, the different Leviathans feel very different.
And the way they work is that you're going to flip over cards. So it's a little like Orleans, because the game structure is on this nice card and it's nice flow. So at the very beginning of your turn, you turn over one of the Leviathan cards. It's going to tell you how it's going to attack that turn. And then like Orleans, it's not going to do that attack until the very end, with some exceptions. Some of them have this swift action that just happens immediately. Guess what? You don't get to do that.
But yeah.
Like you said, you can plan ahead. If it hasn't come up yet, you can think, well, it's going to come up very soon. So you can sort of plan on where you're going to be. So you either have to jump around or figure out how you're going to get out of the way. Not only that, it's happened on everyone's turn. So since it's like sort of a template or something's going to happen, other players are going to have to do something as well, even though it's not their turn. And you're semi-limited on what you can do on your turn. You can sort of let go. You can fall a bit. You can do other things. Whoever's turn it is can play some cards to help other people out. So I love this sort of interaction and how open they made it, that everyone sort of can do anything at any time.
At its best, the Leviathan attack will set a new set of constraints and priorities that will that will influence how you want to play out your turn. At its worst, and this happens a fair bit, it is a blunt instantiation of the clock telling you that you're running out of time that you cannot modify or avoid. So there's damage that you can take as a climber. There you can be forcibly shoved to a different area of the Leviathan as a climber. And both of these are things that you have to take into consideration, but can be mitigated through time and careful effects. And then there are Leviathan attacks that hit someone regardless. There's no way to dodge it. Maybe everyone regardless, and just do corruption. You can't heal corruption. Corruption is just damage that can never, ever go away. And some Leviathans more than others, but all of them to some extent tend to fall into the habit of some of the card effects just being like, everybody gets some corruption. It's like, I get it. The game needs a clock. Leviathan Wilds would be too easy if they didn't have enough of those effects. But what I'm suggesting is that ideally, I would have preferred if Leviathan Wilds had maintained the same level of difficulty or even a higher level of difficulty, but all with these effects that were at least in some way mitigatable because they give you greater degree of control.
So first, a little bit about corruption and then the difficulty. So corruption, like you said, is this timer that you can hardly ever get rid of. And not only do you get corruption from the Leviathan attacks, there are two types of crystals on the Leviathan. One that are purple that you can just break apart. Other ones are teal, which every time you hit them is also going to be corruption. So it's this, you have these two cubes on your board and it's the same track, one on the left, one on the right. If they ever meet, you are unfortunately done.
Corruption is just damage you can't heal. There's no difference between... They could have had it one track and it doesn't matter. It's just true. An easier way to track, and it's a more thematic way to track it. But corruption is just unhealable damage.
And true. And then the problem that we had with other games recently about being able to gauge the difficulty, they do it in a great way because the cards that we talked about that Leviathan has, they have two sides, up or down. And you can just, at the very beginning of the game, have more in their harder side than usual, so you go right to the maximum faster, or you can start with them all on the easy side, and then they will gradually flip over.
Allow me to be extraordinarily blunt and crude, and identify that there's sort of a false dichotomy in co-op games. There are the co-op games where you're wasting time until you can actually achieve the victory state. This is true of Pandemic. You're basically spinning your wheels until such time as the card coughs up enough systems and you're able to spend the actions to get the cards in the right places so you can actually achieve the victory conditions. Shadow Rift is the same way, for what it's worth. At the start of the game, at deal, it is impossible to win. You have to wait for the system to disgorge things. And typically, that pacing, that tempo, is not heavily manipulable. Then, there are games like Leviathan Wilds, where the victory condition at the start of the game is achievable. Destroy all these crystals. All the crystals start out on the board. You know where they are. You need to go get them. And so, the benefit of that is you don't feel like you're just waiting around treading water. The downside is that it becomes a relatively straightforward efficiency race. And I have to say, the quality of the decision-making in Leviathan Wilds, I think, is actually its weakest point. I enjoy a lot about Leviathan Wilds, but in terms of just the kind of trade-offs you have to engage in, it's typically along the lines of, like, okay, here are these crystals. I'm going for this crystal. Okay, let's go for the crystals. What's the best way to smash the crystals? All right, I've got this card that I could play that lets me do a smash at value 3. I think I'll play it to smash this crystal that I'm standing on. Look, I don't mean it's bad. Well, I'm just saying that when compared to the quality of even the world building, the mechanical and thematic quality of the map, of traversal, and all those other things, the actual decision-making, the trade-offs involved, I don't think that's the best part of the game.
True. I wouldn't say it's the best, but I'm going to push back a little bit that there is a little bit more than that. At the beginning of your turn, you're going to flip over the Leviathan card, and then you're going to play a card that's going to dictate how many action points you get. In the top left corner of your card, three cards that you have in your hand, there's a number. And so you have to decide whether you're going to use that for action points or do you want it for your turn. So there's a decision. There's also your deck is also your grip, whether you're going to fall or not. So you decide if you're going to heal this turn or rest so you get your grip back. Or are you going to cycle through some cards because you know there's a better card in your deck that you need to do things. Not only that, on the action point part of the card, there is sort of immunities as well that you could get. You could be immune to corruption that turn. You could be immune to damage. You could have immune to grip loss. And some decks have a lot of immune to corruption, so you might want to cycle a bit through your deck so you're going to hit these corruption things at the right time so you're not going to take that corruption damage. But anyway, like I said, it's a minor pushback. I can see what you're saying, especially near the end where there's three or more players and one crystal left. Then you're like, well, I guess the game's sort of over.
Oh, sure, sure.
Right?
Yeah, well, that's another thing. The arc of Leviathan Wilds is not very good. The tension actually kind of drains out near the last couple turns because it becomes obvious that you're going to win or obvious you can't win. It does build up to a neat level. You start getting a corruption or two. Suddenly you have much less leeway in terms of how much damage you can take. It's overall fine for most of the arc, but it kind of ends on a whimper. The last turn the last turns are pretty unsatisfying. Look, let me just put it this way. So you've got a three card hand. One of them you sock away to be your action points. The other two you can use for their special abilities. One special ability, I'm oversimplifying here. One special ability might be a really good strike. One special ability might be a really good heal, right? And you look at it, am I going to strike this turn? No, I'm not really in a position to strike. Okay, I'll sock that in for action points and I'll heal somebody with his other card. It's stuff like that. It's fine. It's not trivial. I'm not saying it's particularly decrepit. It's just that mostly Leviathan Wilds for me is not something I like to keep going back to because I really feel like the hand and deck and action ability management is super tense and difficult decisions. I do it because cool stuff happens and it's fun to play with the toys. Overall, that's the vibe I get from Leviathan, which is fine. It's a 45-minute game with a relatively light rules and explanation that's colorful and engaging. I just don't think that it's replete with tough choices and difficult trade-offs.
Agreed. Let's talk a bit more about the cards because they are kind of interesting. There's about 10 different occupations. You know, you have your gambler and your magician and your crystal smasher. And
yeah, so, the core professions that you can learn in university, yeah.
Exactly. So at the beginning of the game, you choose an occupation and then you choose a character. Character cards can be anywhere from one or two cards.
The rules call it a deck walker.
Not huge.
It's a deck.
Is it a deck of one card?
That's gotcha. What the rules say. But
so then you take these two decks and you combine them together and that is your deck. And so it's not this huge pile, so you're going to get to know the cards very quickly.
Yes.
And so that is kind of interesting, because some of them are a little bit more complicated than others. Some of them involve tokens.
They introduce very minor sub-mechanisms.
Yeah, so I find that very interesting. And figuring out how they merge together is sometimes useful as well.
It's very much like the Leviathan attacks. Not a whole lot of mechanical complexity, but a lot of flavor that emerges from this. And sure enough, there are some professions and some backgrounds and some characters that lean more into the character support aspect. Because I do appreciate in Leviathan Wilds, the more you're able to play a card for somebody else, the more you're able to spend an action to get someone in a better position. There, I think the quality of decision making is actually at its highest when you're evaluating the efficiency of doing various effects to help out your friends and to be able to use cards with a slightly more latitude. And so that's why I tend to gravitate more towards the support characters. And whether that comes from just cards that affect other climbers more than they affect me, or whether it comes from specific roles with sub-mechanisms, like, for example, the last time I played a character who gave everybody a token that they could exhaust to refresh some of their grip. And I was in a position to refresh those tokens in turn. And so every time they used that effect, I got to feel like I was helping people and there was a greater degree of interactivity, when some of the other backgrounds are a little more straightforward and just make their own actions more efficient.
Agreed. And I do like, there's some sort of puzzle aspect to it as well. You're trying to do the most you can on your turn.
Yeah.
And so you're trying to, you know, use your skills with the action points. It's like, okay, I'm going to use this to, you know, jump across, and I'm going to use this to, you know, glide over to here. And then I'm going to be able to use this card that I didn't think I was going to use at all because I'm so far away, but I used my other two cards to get there. And now I'm going to be able to crush that crystal. So there's a little bit of puzzling out to, you can get the best effect of the cards you happen to have in your hand.
It's true. I think that puzzle would be more satisfying, and indeed lead to more satisfying decision making, if there was yet more ability to support each other, right?
Because
otherwise, all too often, a lot of the turns are just straightforward efficiency actions where it's relatively transparent what you need to do and how you need to do it.
Those puzzle moments are very slim.
I would feel much better if more often you could look at the situation and say, if anybody could get me an extra couple points of movement, that would open up my horizons. And then be like, all right, well, what's the best way to do that? Very often it's, is anyone able to, it's like, none of my cards affect other climbers. Okay. And then you go do your thing. Again, I don't hate those turns.
No.
It's not dollar or anything. There's still toys to be played with. Just I feel like Leviathan Wilds could have been possibly one of the best of the past 5 years in terms of co-ops if it leaned more into that and yet still maintained that tight, focused tone and mechanical and duration level of complexity. I don't know if that's possible, and that's indeed a very, very high lift. But as it is, I'm not frustrated by these absences. I just see how it could have been yet more.
Yeah, and lots of times it is very tense. It comes. The last game we played, unfortunately, was kind of a blowout for the poor Leviathan. But the game...
No, we healed it. We're healing the Leviathan.
Yes,
blocker.
We saved it very easily, I suppose you could say. One before that was right down to the wire where two of the three climbers were out, and the last climber got... Because you get one final turn. Is like, if a climber goes out, then the other two climbers get one final turn. And it just happened that, you know, that one went out, the next person went out, and then the third player was lucky enough to get that final hit on the last crystal and won the game. So a lot of the games are that close. And Leviathan Wilds.
Big fan of Leviathan Wilds for a light co-op that is pleasing in a lot of gameplay and thematic elements. I think it gets a lot right. I just wish there'd been slightly more grist for the action efficiency puzzle that is at the heart of the gameplay. But honestly, that's just a minor downside to an experience that is very reliably charming and enjoyable. I'm a big fan of Leviathan Wilds.
Yeah, I feel the production value is through the roof. Comes with great wooden components, spiral-bound Leviathan book. So you're going through, it's this giant book that takes up the table, so it looks like you're actually climbing around this.
I don't know about giant book, but yes.
Well, for books that come in within a game, it does take up a large part of the table, and you have these nice little meeples that climb around Leviathan, so it gives you the sense of scale. Leviathan Wild. I'll play it anytime. Gonna keep it.
And that's going to do it for this week. Thank you very, very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We appreciate you deciding to spend the time. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find all our contact information at sowronggames.com. We'll read everything you send us and we'll get back to you if we can. Hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McMahon. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.